Welcome to The Athlete and the NARP. I'm Jenna Daly, and I'm the athlete.
And I'm Claire Fenton, and I'm the NARP. And if you don't know what a NARP is, then you're one too.
Welcome to the 17th episode of The Athlete and the NARP. Today we're going to be revisiting a topic that we've touched on in the past in some of our previous episodes, which is NCAA eligibility. And we're returning to this topic because recently the NCAA announced that they're going to be having a meeting in the near future, within the next few months, to seriously discuss implementing what they're calling a 5-in-5 rule. And basically what that means is that they're considering limiting athletes to 5 years of eligibility in 5 seasons. So we're going to get into kind of the nitty-gritty of why this has been sparked. There are a bunch of different lawsuits going on from various different players in the NCAA who are seeking extra eligibility, sometimes up to like 6 or 8 years. There are some players right now that are currently playing that are in their like mid-20s that we're going to kind of just discuss like how they're able to kind of get to that point and maybe why the NCAA is hoping to limit that, especially with NIL now and the way that players are able to be paid. There's a lot of incentive, obviously, for players to be staying in the NCAA longer if they can, especially ones that are not maybe planning to go pro, the ones that are just below that level. They can make a lot of money if they can stay a couple of years. There's a ton of things going on, and there's a lot of different issues that kind of are surrounding this. But just to quickly discuss the 5-in-5, currently what athletes are allowed to do is they have 10 semesters to play 4 years of college sports. And right now they can get their fifth year or like extend beyond that by using something called like a red shirt or like a special waiver if they were injured for part of a year. Special circumstances, they have to submit a waiver that has to be approved by the NCAA. Also with the pandemic, any players that were around during the 2020 to 2021 season got like just a blanket extra year of eligibility, like no waiver or anything required. So this upcoming year, like 2024 to 2025, like the end of this season, is the last year for those players who were around at that time to be able to use that extra year. Once that's over, I think the NCAA is looking to try to actually sit down and come up with like new rules, because there has been, you know, what maybe some people call like a bit of abuse of these extra years, or just a bunch of players, like we've talked about before with the transfer portal, just floating around and switching schools like nobody's business. And so it's definitely something that the NCAA wants to watch and maybe try to regulate, A, because as Jenna's going to talk about, of some of the cases that our players are actually taking to court to try to extend their stay, which the NCAA doesn't want to be tied up in these legal battles that could potentially cause ramifications that are not good for them all the way down the line. There are implications for future athletes trying to gain a roster spot and for the teams and the way they're set up currently, especially with the scholarship limitations that we've talked about previously coming into place. There's a lot at play here, and I'm just going to let Jenna a little bit discuss some of the like actual legal implications that are happening in court right now, because that's more in her wheelhouse and not in mine.
Well, I feel like article after article of the NCAA is like another lawsuit of this player wanting this and then the court going against the NCAA. Like,
they're not winning.
At this point, I almost feel bad for them because they have, I don't know, I think out of everything that I researched for this, they had a singular win.
Wow.
And that was because the player essentially didn't have an argument. And so we kind of keep coming back to college sports, but I think that's going to be something that is going to be in a headline every other week. There's always going to be something going on.
It's approaching, like, this semi-professional landscape for, I mean, a minority of players, but, like, also a significant...
Right.
It has significant ramifications.
Yeah. And I definitely think that was kind of a criticism of the whole NIL settlement that they're still trying to figure out right now. Yeah, they, like, definitely. Kind of are getting closer to that, which, I mean, we talked about that in a different episode. We'll touch on that again with the Ivy League. But it also kind of came up in a lot of these articles, too, because it was really saying one of the arguments that the NCAA says is you only have this amount, you're only allotted this amount of time, so that way new players can come in and get this chance, and only 2% of athletes actually go pro. And so then if you're having these people linger because they can't go pro, then like, what's the difference between the college sports product and then like a professional product, which makes sense mm-hmm. to me. But the one example I wanted to bring up right away, because I thought this was crazy. There's this basketball player, DeJon Clayton, last season, was granted an 8th college basketball season.
So insane.
And I just wanna run through like his history, yeah. just so you can hear it, and then I'll tell you why the court decided to give him an 8th year of eligibility. So he started at, I think, Copan State is how you pronounce it, and then he played, I don't know if he played, but he was on the roster freshman year.
Sure.
He received a medical hardship waiver his sophomore year for an injury, and he stayed there all 4 years. He graduated in 2020, but played a 5th year there using his waiver eligibility. It didn't specify if he, like, did a grad year or whatever, mm-hmm. so he was there for 5 years. Then, so obviously 2020 is like the COVID eligibility. So for the 21-22, I believe, there's so many different schools, he transferred to University of Hartford. And that's when he used his extra COVID eligibility as a grad student. But he ended up only playing 2 games for them before getting injured and got another medical exemption. Also, I think important to note, I don't believe you said this earlier, but at this time, there was a freeze on the 10-semester rule with like the COVID and the eligibility and everything. So this sounds ridiculous because he started school in 2016 and finished in like 2024, but it is crazy. But important to note that if that's confusing,
yeah.
like he wasn't being penalized for any of this or anything. Then he transferred to University of California, Berkeley. Played in 9 games, but he injured his hamstring. And so he also, what's another part of like this whole lawsuit to get another waiver, was that he alleged like mental health duress after being forced to play while injured. So I'm not really sure there was also something else there, or mm-hmm. if that was just like an exaggeration yeah. to get a waiver. Who knows? He transferred to Manhattan College, but wasn't allowed to join the roster because of the rule was back in place, and so they said that the court wouldn't grant the exemption because he had played the 9 games, and it wasn't really like a season-ending injury. It was just, it was serious, but mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. career-ending. So they originally said no. So you'd think he'd be done at this point, like, give it up, hang up the shoes, yeah. put the basketball
it's
away.
It's time.
Yeah, it's time. No, he didn't. So not only did he not give up, he didn't even try to appeal that one. He went and sued under a different claim, which I find a little absurd, but the claim is that he'd suffer irreparable harm by being denied opportunities to showcase his basketball talents for professional basketball leagues around the world. I'll let that one sink in.
That's what I like about, like, lawyers. They can be creative. Yeah,
they really can. I know, I read that and I was like, wow. Ridiculous, but impressive. And so irreparable harm in this case is kind of like a damage that money can't repair. So even if, like, so the whole point of that was kind of like the NIL opportunities. Uh-huh. And so what his lawyer is saying is that he can't just get paid back pay for the NIL opportunity he'd miss out on or something, that he really needed to play to sure. showcase himself. And even though he wasn't an NBA prospect by any means, supposedly he maybe could have had a career internationally or like in the G League or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something. And so the court actually granted him an exemption, allowing him an 8th semester, or I guess 8th season of basketball, way too many semesters to count. Mm-hmm. And they cited that a denial of eligibility could carry a detrimental residual effect on his pro basketball prospects and NIL opportunities.
Jenna had briefly told me about this before we started recording, and I just think it's so It's so confusing. Like, it's hard to say we, like, lost the plot on what the NCAA is supposed to be, because I think the NCAA has been treating itself as, like, semi-professional mm-hmm. without letting the athletes reap the benefits of being semi-professional right. for a long time. So even though we've kind of have this idea that the NCAA is about academics with kind of sports on the side as, like, an added bonus, I think it would be just naive to say that, especially with, like, football and basketball, which is where a lot of these cases are coming from, that that's just not how it's been treated.
Right.
And so now with the NIL blowing things open and they're getting these cases in court, we have, you know, stuff like this where people are able to argue that. And it's, on one side, you want the athletes to be able to have, like, their autonomy and their agency, and if they're going to be part of this, like, semi-professional machine, to be able to exercise the rights they might normally have. But at the same time, like, the idea that a 26-year-old is treating his college career as a money-making opportunity for future professional prospects is a little, I don't know if concerning is the right word, but it's just a strange shift, I guess, mm-hmm. like, in how, again, part of why the NCAA is trying to get, like, a firmer grasp on how their athletes use their eligibility.
Yeah, I saw this quote when I was reading some articles, and it said what started as kind of, like, a fun, challenging hobby has now become a billion-dollar brand.
Literally,
and I think, yeah. like, that's exactly what you were saying. It's really just changed the way that people are using it and viewing it. And my thing when I was reading this, and I was just like, if he's not an NBA prospect, I think... The article even said that he's older than, like, Jason Tatum and, like, Luka. Like,
I mean, 26, I think, like, 26 to 28-ish, I could be wrong. I feel like that's, like, prime years for a lot of athletes.
Yeah, I would say so.
So, like, if you're it like, oh, like I'm it. A prospect at the point where maybe you're supposed to be at your prime, that's
yeah.
a little,
yeah. like you're what are we peaking? Doing here? I don't know. Yeah. So that's, yeah, my thing. I'm like, how long are you going to drag it out before you realize that, like, it's not going to be your career?
Mm-hmm. like, yeah.
8 years might be a little long. I don't know.
I also just can't imagine that, I mean, given the types of colleges that you listed that he played at, that he mm-hmm. was even reaping a ton of NIL benefits either.
Right. I mean,
it's not like it was Kentucky and Duke
exactly,
and UNC.
Yeah.
Like,
I really don't think so. And honestly, it wasn't that he was a bad player, but I'm pretty sure his best game was one of his undergrad years. It sure. had said, I don't know which one, but it had said at Copenhagen State.
Yeah,
so.
Sure.
It's not like he was progressing tremendously, this crazy great player that, like, stood out
yeah.
at these programs.
Definitely.
So,
yeah.
So I don't know. I don't see the benefit other than if you really could secure NIL opportunities. He did say in the argument that potentially having an athletic scholarship would allow him to complete his master's degree or grad degree, whatever he was getting. I don't know how sincere that argument is just based on mm-hmm. this. I mean, it's hard to believe that you'd go to three different grad schools to complete a degree, you know?
But so. Also for me, I'm like, you know, you not having enough years left to get the degree you want is, like, not my problem, Loki. Like, if I'm the yeah. judge, I'm like, okay,
exactly.
sorry. Like, you know, I feel like I said to Jenna actually earlier, I was like, you know, if I wanted to go to med school... Like, if I did 4 years of college athletics and now I want to go to med school, and I'm like, oh, but, like, Your Honor, like, I need 4 more years because I have to go to med school. Like, that doesn't...
Yeah.
It's like, who cares? So that's not my problem. Like, you get what you get, and
right.
if you can't pay for the school, then you shouldn't be going.
Yeah, well, because I had a teammate, I think 2 years ago now, and she was getting her PhD and her MD. So she was actually going to be in school, I think, for 7.5 years. After undergrad.
Wow. Yeah.
And so imagine, like, if she had eligibility and, like, was competing until she was, what, 30?
Yeah,
like,
that's insane. So ridiculous.
That's, imagine, like, 30-year-olds
yeah.
regularly being in the NCAA. Yeah. I don't know. That's where, like, when we're talking about differentiating college sports and then pro sports, that's where I do think that you really need to limit it. And I also saw the whole COVID eligibility play out, because I'm the first year that, like, has had 4 normal years of college athletics. So mm-hmm. I, like, my year does not have any COVID eligibility, but we're still seeing everyone else with it because the past few years in running, like, even at the D3 level, it was dominated by, like, grad students. Everyone that was winning things was, like, 23, 24, 25. There was one girl, she competed a few years, got married, so then she came, and we didn't know, and she came back, and we were like, who is this? Like, another one? Oh, my God. Then we realized she got married because she was literally, like, 25.
That's so
and
funny.
She was still competing and winning cross-country nationals.
Yeah.
And at that point, it's like, all right, well, how can you, if you're, like, naturally progressing and you only have your 4 years, like someone in my year, I don't really know how fair that is.
And I understand, like, there, it gets a little shaky when you want to try to put an age limit on something.
Right, yeah.
But
I agree.
When, you know, we have seen, like, there were players this year, for example, in college football that are in their 30s. Like, there was one guy who played for Virginia this year who was a kicker, I believe, or special teams, but he's 34.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, he had a year to come back and he could do it. But I'm like, again, it's like, what is college athletics for? Is it for 30-year-olds who want to come back to school? I thought this was more of just a funny story because I don't think anyone was necessarily harmed by it. But J.R. Smith, I don't know if anybody remembers him, but he was on the championship-winning team with, like, LeBron and then also with him on the Lakers and was kind of just a good role player for the Cavs and the Lakers. And after he retired from the NBA, he went back to college to get his degree and decided to be on the golf team at North Carolina A&T State University because he went to the NBA straight out of high school. So he had 4 years that he had, like, not used at all. And he was just like, well, if I'm here, you know, might as well also just play golf. And I think it was, like, a good situation. Like, I think his teammates really liked him, and it was all cool. But it's very interesting that he can do that. He was 38 at the time. It's very odd that is something that, like, sure, he still has his eligibility, but it's like, do we want 38-year-olds who come back to school to be competing with 18-year-olds, like people that are 20 years their junior? Thankfully, golf is not, like, a physical sport, but like, for the sports that are more physical or where maybe that is, can be more impactful, it's a little, it's just a little strange. Like, his teammate is 18. If he had started golfing when he was 18, he would have more years of experience golfing than his teammate is old. You know what I mean? Like, so it's like, it's a little strange, but
it's actually such a funny way to put
it.
Yeah.
It's such an odd situation, but there's just the line between these two things gets kind of blurry.
Mm-hmm.
This one was kind of well known, but Vanderbilt's quarterback for this past season, his name is Diego Pavia. He filed a lawsuit in November that was basically trying to argue against a current NCAA rule that limits the number of seasons that JUCO, or junior college, players can compete at Division I schools. So right now, his time that he spent at JUCO was, like, counting toward his 5 years of NCAA eligibility, and he was arguing that shouldn't be the case because that limits his ability to then earn NIL, which he couldn't have done really at the JUCO level, but now can at the NCAA. That irreparable harm that we're talking about.
Yes.
And currently, this one is still ongoing. So he was denied the request for a temporary restraining order, which would have, like, let him get that additional year. But they did grant him an injunction that could potentially allow him to play in 2025. He played at New Mexico Military Institute from 2020 to 2021, New Mexico State from January 2022 to 2024. He transferred to Vanderbilt in January 2024, and then he wants to play again next year. So there's also this, like, again, blurring the line between, like, JUCO, junior college, and D1, and, like, how do we let the eligibility play out from there, which is also, like, again, another interesting aspect where, again, like, now they're getting caught up in this legal battle about JUCO. They're getting caught up in the legal battle with this guy about his 28,000th year of playing in the NCAA. Like, they have a lot going on, and I think these are not good. It's not good for them to have these open lawsuits. Like, I think they're really feeling, like, a little bit of pressure to make a rule that works, that hopefully won't have any legal ramifications down the line, and just, like, that be the end of it. Yeah. Like, no more lawsuits.
The hardest part when they're going through all of these lawsuits is that even though whatever the court decides in these specific lawsuits, none of them are technically binding for any other cases that are similar, but they really do set a precedent for what happens next. So when you have someone who gets an eighth year and then someone wants like a sixth year and they're like, well, why didn't I get that? When they have a very similar story to me, and it's just like all of a sudden it's like, this is subjective, you're treating me worse, blah blah blah, and then it just kind of just is completely blown out of proportion. So they're really getting hammered hard and like that's a tough situation, because it does seem like right now a lot of the courts are siding with like student athletes, and they're saying that yes, like it's now become semi-professional, you should be rewarded for it, blah blah blah, which isn't a bad take.
No,
I don't think it is. I don't think anyone really would think it is. Mm-hmm. But it does come up with a lot of things like this where you're not really thinking about, okay, like what are the actual implications of allowing NIL to dictate like where people transfer and how much people can get paid. So I think that's interesting.
And with the 5-5, like part of what they're hoping to do is say like no red shirts allowed, no waivers allowed, because they were also saying with the waivers, a player can apply and say, I want an extra year. The NCAA can deny it, but then the player can then challenge it. And so it becomes really difficult for the NCAA to even deny waivers in the first place. So it's like, why do we even have this system set up if it's really not doing anything on our end? Like, people can just challenge it and then get the year that they need anyway. So they're considering, like, no waivers, no red shirts, just 5-5, like, kind of end of story, and just kind of blanket it there, which obviously can have its ramifications, but it can be good as well, especially, I guess, when we're thinking about high schoolers who are trying to come into college, and if we have all these factors crashing in of people wanting to stay longer because of NIL so they can make their money, plus the new scholarship limits where we're having, like, roster cuts so that teams can kind of work with the new scholarship format that we had talked about previously, plus, you know, the way that COVID year and everything has played out with, like, people taking 6, 7, 8 extra years, or very normal to take 5, we're just, like, there's just not going to be space if we let this continue. There's just not going to be space for, incoming high schoolers to have those spots. And that's the NCAA, I think, would definitely rather prioritize those kids coming out of high school, getting them a spot, than somebody who's already been here for 5, 6 years, who's really probably should just move on anyway, whether they were injured or not. It's like, you know, sometimes it's not always fair. Sometimes your time passes, and it's just, and I think they're trying to just work through that system and make sure that it's a little bit more predictable in terms of, like, how many people are leaving, how many people are coming up, like, making it just more of a system in that sense.
Yeah, that was actually something that I saw firsthand trying to be recruited during COVID. I was obviously very fortunate with running. It's black or white. Like, you're fast enough you're not. I mean, there's a little bit, like, they can evaluate your potential, whatever, but track has, and to some extent cross-country too, like, you're not really limited to a roster. There's not, like, specific positions. There might be varsity or not, but, like, you earn that spot as soon as you get there, whereas I actually had some friends who were trying to be recruited, I think, for soccer, and were really running into that where the other players, because of COVID, were going to come back, or other people were transferring to their school because it was one of, like, a very top educational school. And so the coach was like, you're good enough to play here, I just don't have a spot for you. And so they ended up not committing anywhere because it was just too difficult to find somewhere. So I did see that, and I think that's kind of really only the beginning of what this could be. And I remember that being very stressful for, I mean, not only myself, but everyone who had it far worse than I did. That was, and with COVID, like, even if they did have spots and things, I did have a few coaches tell me that they couldn't, like, offer support during the recruitment cycle and, like, application cycle. And so that might be a thing too, where now maybe they do have spots, or they'll maybe leave, like, X amount of spots for people coming out of high school, but they might not support them because they're probably not as strong of a candidate as someone who has a proven track record.
A known entity versus someone with potential. But
And potential is great, and honestly, I think that's more important to develop, but but that's not always how sports are, and certain sports care less about that. It's less important, so.
And I think, I think, like, one of the other things is, specifically with basketball, because we've been talking about a little bit, is, like, the one-and-done rule that is a thing, where with the NBA right now, the minimum draft age is 19. Players, if they're top prospects, will just do 1 year at college fully with the intent that they're dipping in March to go to the NBA and, like, not even finishing the year, really. And just as long as they can remain academically eligible up until that point, then they can play. And especially with top programs like Duke and Kentucky, it's like there's, you know, been multiple years where, like, 3-4 players will come in, like, they're starting as freshmen and then they're gone the next year. And it's just, like, this massive rotation through the program. A lot of this stuff where we're talking about, again, these lawsuits and maybe those types of issues or this roster changing, a lot of it is happening on the men's side, specifically with basketball and football, because of the propensity of professional opportunities for them, which isn't as prevalent on the women's side.
The WNBA actually has, I don't know if you saw this, I saw this very recently. They actually have a rule against the one-and-done rule.
Yeah.
And they said, like, it would destroy the WNBA if it was a thing.
Exactly.
And, like, college. Women's basketball.
The WNBA, you have to be 22, I believe, to be drafted, or you have to have finished, like, your fourth year of college.
Or within 3 months of graduation.
Exactly. Like, you have to basically be done with college.
Yeah.
And the idea was, like, oh, should we lower that? Should we make it, like, the men's rule? And that's, like, Gino Auriemma, who's the UConn women's head coach, who's kind of, like, a legend because UConn is so good.
I saw him in the airport once, no big deal.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did.
That's kind of iconic. Did you say hi?
Yeah, I waved.
Oh, amazing. I'm jealous.
Yeah. I got an autograph from the assistant coach, and I'm blanking on her name right now, but it was really cool.
That's cool. Yeah. That's really neat. He said, like, oh, yeah, if we do that for the women's game, it'll ruin it, because players will come in and out like they do with the men. They'll just come in and out, and it's like if you're trying to develop women's sports, which I think the NCAA in particular can definitely be an avenue for that. And it has been with, like, Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese recently. When you have these players, like, these names that stick around for 4 years and can make an impact in that way, with women's basketball, like, you want players sticking around for 4 years. And NIL now gives them a reason to stick around for 4 years, where in the past, for them, it's like they're going, like, a lot of these players, like Paige Beckers or Caitlin Clark, like, they're making more off their NIL than their WNBA salary is, which, of course, then that NIL stuff carries over with them into the WNBA because they have their sponsorships. But it's like now there's, like, no reason to leave college early because they can build up their name and their brand and make a lot of money in college, get their degree, which will still be very helpful for them, and then go play pro if they want. And, like, it's a really good system that way for at least the women's side. And so I think having long way of saying having those stricter policies in place, I think will be good for women's sports, obviously women's basketball in particular, but other sports like that where people tune in more to maybe the collegiate level than they do the professional level, or there's, like, very high level of play there, a good way to grow the game and get people more interested.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about that, it reminded me of kind of the change in the transfer eligibility that we had kind of talked about earlier today. But I was looking into it, and I guess the NCAA, I think as all of this is shifting, the NCAA is shifting further and further away from the student part of student athletes, and it's just focused on being athletes, which is very different than in what it used to be. So to kind of give a little bit of background, because I think that'll be helpful, is that previously athletes could transfer once without a penalty. There didn't need to be, like, a cause or a reason or anything. And then the second time, they either had to obtain a waiver or they had to forego a year of eligibility at whatever school that they were playing at. And so there was a lot of talk recently about these players kind of being at a competitive disadvantage to, I don't know, I guess
people once transferring. Once they've sat out a year, you mean? Or
for once they've transferred once already, after that. So kind of saying that, like, schools are less interested in recruiting them, even if they are part of the top talent, whatever, which makes sense. That generally is difficult. It's also, I thought, important to note that only at that time, only 0.17% of students transferred twice and tried to apply for a waiver. So it either was very discouraged or people just weren't interested in it. And then now, the NCAA at that time, when people were pushing against them, they had argued that limiting the transfer portal allowed athletes to be student athletes and actually focus on their education and getting their degree while also building that team chemistry without disruptions, like you were talking about and things. And so I think with a lot of these legal battles, the NCAA, whether it's against their will or willingly, they've been straying away from more of that student part of student athletes. And so you're really seeing college athletes be kind of a phrase rather than student athletes, which I think is a very big change. And then, so they actually fought this for a while, but that was their stance then. And then that was in December of 2023 when this lawsuit came about. And then in April of 2024, the chair, also this is only at the Division I level, just to be clear. The chair of the D1 Council says NCAA members continue to prioritize long-term academic success for college athletes who transfer while supporting their opportunity to compete immediately. We hope that this practical approach to transfer eligibility requirements will encourage student athletes to make well-informed decisions about transferring and the impact such a move could have on their ability to graduate on time. So it kind of sounds like they're not thrilled.
Yeah.
But don't really have a choice. And so that statement there is like, you can do this, but there are going to be ramifications if mm-hmm. you do.
Mm-hmm. And I think maybe it's a good segue then into the Ivy League and what they decided to do recently, which Jen and I had brought up earlier, I think in a previous episode, about just with this NIL stuff, some of the Ivy League schools were taking a very hard stance on the student-athlete portion. Like, our athletes are students, very much first and foremost. The NIL stuff is very secondary, even though they do compete at the Division I level. So it was like they already don't get athletic scholarships because the Ivy League took their stance on that. They were not prioritizing NIL because, again, they're trying to prioritize that student-athlete experience. But recently, what was the new news for that?
Oh, is this my turn?
I wanted to share because you were very like,
well, okay,
up in arms.
Because now I have a different opinion after we talked about it and kind of like ragged on them. And like, up until now, I've been saying the Ivy League has been really outdated with what they're saying, and they're going to be left behind when it comes to this. And so the news is that the Ivy League a few days ago decided to opt out of the NCAA versus House, among others, et al., I guess, settlement, kind of doubling down on their academic focus. And so that means that they won't be subject to the roster limits. They won't have to pay their players. They still don't have NIL collectives or committees, and those won't appear anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they've never had athletic scholarships, and it doesn't sound like they want to change that anytime soon. And so I do think that when it comes to the grand scheme of, like, major sports, football and basketball and some other larger ones, like, yes, they're absolutely going to be left behind. Like, but at the same time, they were never known for those. Like, none of, you don't go to an Ivy League because only for athletics, you know? Like, you go because it's a good, holistic way to be a student athlete. And so that was what they actually said here. And so one point I didn't really think about, but an article brought up, is they're not super competitive in football or basketball, but they're very competitive in smaller, like, niche sports. And they actually had a ton of Olympians in the Paris Olympics and stuff. And so that might actually, if they continue to not care about that, they don't care. And they also do encourage their student athletes to partake in NIL. It's not like they can't. It's just that they don't want to manage it. Yeah, exactly. Like, they don't really want to have their hand in it.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing when we talked about the NCAA versus House was that, like, smaller football, basketball programs are going to be really harmed, and it might actually harm more niche sports and stuff. And so I think that's true. But this actually might be a really smart move for the Ivy League if their more important sports are the small niche ones that would be directly impacted by that settlement. For them to opt out, it might be the best move.
Yeah, I think it's just, obviously, what makes it complicated is that they're doing nothing to increase the net of students that they could be recruiting. Because, obviously, those type of niche Olympic sports are sports that are usually expensive to expensive to do. Squash, for example.
Yeah, squash,
Or something like that. Like, the stuff that's kind of like what's the word for it? But, like, country club sports is kind of
equestrian.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking equestrian specifically. I don't know, but I didn't know if they had it. But even
I don't
if they,
know if they do either.
Even if they do or not, I'm sure they have something similar along that vein. But these country club sports where it's, like, already they're expensive to get into, so you're selecting on that group already, and then the amount of people that play those sports that can pay now it's getting up to like $80,000 a year to go to an Ivy League school for 4 years. Like, then you're shrinking that even more. Mm-hmm. Then the amount of students that want to do that, knowing that there's no NIL support for them there, when they could go to a school like Stanford, a school like Michigan, a school like Duke, that is honestly, at the end of the day, probably equally as good for them, mm-hmm. but will provide them with so many more athletic opportunities. Right. Like, they're just, you know, there's definitely an argument to be made, right, that they're obviously not thinking about, like, the basketball and the football like these other schools are, because they're light years away from being competitive in those without athletic scholarships. Ever. Right. But at the same time, like, even for the ones that are more niche, not saying that their programs are going to go downhill, but they're really just, like, if I was an athlete who was good enough to go to Princeton and good enough to go to Stanford, and I had offers from both, mm-hmm. I don't understand a world in which it makes more sense to go to Princeton for a sport, because,
right.
like, at Stanford, for example, like, you know, there are many strong academic schools in the other Division I conferences, right. like, going to any of those and having all that support just seems like a much, much better deal, unless it doesn't matter how much money you're getting, unless you can just pay no matter what it is, and you feel like a very, very strong tie to mm-hmm. one of those Ivy League schools, which some people do, and that's fine. Yep. But it's just going to be interesting to see how it does shake out for them, because it's like, without question, they will lose recruits or players. Uh-huh. People will transfer. Like,
yep.
stuff is going to happen, and that is a little... I don't know if, like, sad is the right word, but it's, like, sometimes some strong basketball players or, like, some strong talent in some of these other sports would, like, sneak through occasionally and, like, get mm-hmm. to the Ivy League, and they go far in the tournaments or whatever, but I just don't see that happening anymore.
Yeah, I definitely think they are at a loss short term. It'll be interesting to see long term, because if it does play out where those niche programs are concentrated to only a select few, then people may go to the Ivy Leagues. But if they stick around and everything, and that's something that the NCAA really does want to protect, then that severely harms the Ivy League. Mm-hmm. So only time will tell, I guess.
For sure. Another, like, very niche point that I just thought of that actually kind of relates back to Emory is that I forget who I was talking with about it, but I think I made a comment when I was working for the athletic department last year, like, wow, a lot of these players on these sports are fifth years, like, across, even from Emory's side, but then also from some of the other teams they played in the mm-hmm. UAA. I was like, wow, there's a lot of fifth years here. And I know in particular, actually, then my dad said, well, the nice thing about a lot of the schools in the UAA is that they have grad programs and they yep. have professional yep. schools and stuff like that. Like, Emory has a billion of them. So athletes that are coming from either a Division I school or another Division III program that want to keep playing, that have their eligibility, they can easily get their master's, their, like, PhD, mm-hmm. their med school, like, their law yeah. school. Like, they can easily get whatever degree they want here mm-hmm. and also do that. Like, some schools just don't have that.
Right.
Like, my dad played basketball at Bucknell, and he was saying, like, they don't have any... So they don't have anything. So it's really hard for them sometimes to recruit when there's these extra years of eligibility at play, because they can really only keep people who have to do their undergrad mm-hmm. and they don't have opportunities for people that have their extra year. Like, they just lose some of that recruiting ground, whereas schools that have a lot of those opportunities, like, are benefiting more from these extra years of eligibility or even just a regular fifth year, because they obviously then athletes can come there and get their extra degrees where they can't at other schools. So that's just another thing that's, like, interesting and at play. And again, this guy that we were talking about earlier who's on his eighth year, who knows how long it's taking him to do, what degrees he has. Like, maybe it's
I want to know what degree he's getting at this point. Maybe, but like, if you could have four.
You could have a lot. I mean, it's 8 years is, like, two full undergrads. Like, he could be doing a lot of things. But if you were to, like, really use your 8 years and try to do that, you know, you'd obviously be needing to look at schools that have, like, a pretty robust professional or, you know, advanced degree programs. Mm-hmm.
For this week's Fun Friday, Claire and I have put together our dream, kind of ideal halftime performance. So we split it up and we have...
Super Bowl halftime performance.
Yeah. Yes. Naturally. That's the only one that matters. So, but yeah, so we're going to have our headliner. Then we'll have kind of like our main side act. So who comes out, maybe sing some of their own songs, collabs, whatever. We'll have two surprise guests, And then we'll have our opening song, our crowd favorite, and then our closing song. So, Claire, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So, just to start off, we're going to have my headliner. And this is someone I was recently talking with a friend about. Genuinely, I think within, I don't know if it'll happen, but like I think they genuinely could get a Super Bowl halftime show. And that is Miley Cyrus.
Oh.
Would be my headliner.
Yeah.
And I think she would be really good for a couple of reasons. I think, A, she has, like, a very wide discography. She's been doing music ever since she was young. And so, you can't escape some of her most popular songs. So, like, people are going to know some, at least, like, a lot of the songs she's singing. Mm-hmm. Then I think also she's so versatile vocally that she can do, like, country. She can do pop. She can, like, she sounds incredible live. And she's also very energetic. She can, like, mm-hmm. move around, like, do the performance aspect of things. And she has so many different eras also that she can kind of bring to light and kind of do. So I think overall, it would be a fantastic performance. I'm going to go through the people that I think mm-hmm. that I want to be with her, and then I'll talk through the individual, you know, three songs that I've chosen. But I would want her main side act to be Ariana Grande,
okay.
which we're shooting big.
We're shooting really big. Yes.
But I think they both come from similar backgrounds in terms of, like, being child stars. And they also, Ariana also has a really wide discography. She has incredible vocals. I think they could, like, mesh well together if they're singing some of, like, I think Ariana could join in on some of Miley's and then also do some of her own. They also have a song together that I really like called Don't Call Me Angel that they could perform.
That's a good song.
Which is also, like, very energetic and upbeat and I think would be good. And I think Ariana, like, she would be a good side act because, like, she would be my ideal headliner, but I think she's kind of past her touring phase a little bit. So I don't think she would want to do the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a lot for her. So we're going to give her, like, the main side act position.
Okay. She can handle that.
She can handle that. So my two small secondary acts, they're just going to pop in, pop out, do their thing. First one is going to be Justin Bieber.
I knew it. I knew he'd show up somewhere in your lineup.
He has to show up. He has to show up.
Okay.
When I was in first grade, my mom took me to see the Justin Bieber, like, Never Say Never documentary.
Mm.
And I vividly remember life-changing.
Mm-hmm.
Still, one of us cried. It wasn't me. so everyone involved was heavily emotionally affected. But there was one scene in there where Miley Cyrus is in the documentary and they performed a song together. I believe it was Overboard, which she's not on the original My World 2.0 album, but she sang it in a performance with him at a concert, and she was, like, quoted in there. She talked about him a little bit for, like, 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think they could, like, recreate that and come back together and, you know, sing together again at the Super Bowl. That would do a lot for me personally, and so I would really appreciate it. Then also, Justin is definitely past his touring phase.
Yeah.
So he's definitely, like, a pop-in, pop-out. Like, he's done performances within the past couple of years. He sounded amazing, does a really good job. So I think he would be good to join in. Then also, he and Ariana Grande have a song together called Stuck With You, which is, like, a little bit more slowed down, but I think, like, you know, they could work it in. You need both. So I think he would be my main side act. Also, again, for very selfish reasons, just because I love Justin Bieber. Then my other side act, this is where we're taking a slight turn, but I think we need it, is Wiz Khalifa. Because Miley Cyrus, him, and Juicy J, who I couldn't fit into the program, have a song called 23.
Okay.
Which
they
is
can
like
play her track in the back.
Yeah, exactly. They can put him on the background. It's all good. But he can rap his verse. She can sing her part
mm-hmm.
of the song. That one's like very like it brings that more like clubby hip hop vibe to the set list. Which again,
yeah.
She's versatile. She can do that too. And I wanted to be able to showcase that that is something they can bring to it. And so I think I want him there. Also, he's from Pittsburgh, so represent at the Super Bowl on the biggest stage. That would be incredible. So that's kind of what we got going on for the vibes.
Yeah.
This is very personalized to me.
It is.
I don't know how wide of a market. But I think, I do genuinely think Miley would be a really, really good headliner.
I think she would be able to, she's a great performer and then can also, like, engage the crowd well.
Yeah.
She, like, can sing and dance. Like, she kind of
mm-hmm.
does everything.
Yeah.
So
she's used to
good.
The spotlight and
right.
performing at that level because obviously she's been doing it since she was, like,
mm-hmm.
13. Song-wise, opener, crowd favorite, closer. Opener, I mean, come on, Party in the USA. Can you imagine? Everything's dark. It's all black. And you just hear, do, 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 do. And I'd be like,
yeah.
I'd be like so excited.
Yeah.
I think like you have to open with that. Obviously she has to play it, but I think that would be a great way. Like that's a song everybody knows. Gets
mm-hmm.
everybody going. Like you're on your feet. Crowd favorite. I think we get to the middle of the show, we like slow it down a little bit. We got these songs, like they need a breather. They've been up, they've been dancing, yeah. they've been performing. We got the climb. And this is where I think Ariana and Justin can truly shine. Is I think they can also jump onto this song. They can do some great harmonies. They can each take a little bit of some of the verse. And they all can relate to that song and its message, that's I feel true. Like. So
I really feel like Justin's voice would sound very good there.
Can you imagine? I am.
I said,
and it sounds incredible. Imagine everybody in the crowd with like their flashlights on their phones, just like singing along to the climb. I think that would be incredible. And the closer, I think We Can't Stop would be like the closer, because it's a party song for sure. Like it has that vibe, but it's also like it's a little bit more slowed down. But it has like a good like again, We Can't Stop, and it's like a like we're closing out the night with this and. Yeah, I feel like it leaves with, like, the right amount of energy, something you can, like, belt out to.
Yeah.
So that would be my ideal Super Bowl in a nutshell.
Yeah.
There's definitely a theme, and that's okay.
That's totally
okay. I'm the target audience for
this. You clearly are.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, I think they would give a solid performance. I think, yeah, they'd all mesh well. And all of them are used to touring globally, yeah. so... Nothing would really throw them off.
Mm-hmm.
They could probably put together a lot of good choreography and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, Justin dances very well. So.
He does.
Him, Miley Cyrus. I don't know how much Ariana Grande.
She definitely did a lot with her previous tour. Okay. But, yeah. I mean, she's classically trained.
Wiz
she's in Wicked.
Khalifa would just kind of, yeah. Very true.
Wiz Khalifa would just kind of vibe. He'd be that's the vibe. He'd literally center, pop in, rap 16 bars,
and be
pop
out.
That's
yeah.
fine.
No, I get that. Okay. I like that one.
All right, I'm excited to see what you have. Because yeah. we don't necessarily share always yeah. the same taste in music, which is totally fine.
Yeah.
And so
this
I'm
one is
see.
Actually very, very different than, like, my music taste in
ooh.
General,
uh-oh.
I'd actually say. Because originally I was thinking about doing Taylor Swift, and I think there are so many songs that you could do with her and everything, and, like, honestly, at some point, maybe she'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
I picked a different person because it's someone that I think... has a brilliant voice, and I know, unfortunately, that they will never do the Super Bowl because they have said that.
Oh.
They have one of the best voices I've ever heard, and that is Adele. And even though, one thing I was kind of like, I don't know about her because, like, a lot of her songs are a little bit slower and everything, but I think she has a lot of old songs that are just, like, everyone knows them.
For sure.
And also, like, the Super Bowl, I don't know, it feels like a really long event, so I think that hers, like... She's not a big dancer. Like, it's not, like, super high energy, but I think she could put on a beautiful performance. And so
yeah.
I think if she was just, like, picturing her standing in, like, the middle of the stage with just, like, a single spotlight or something and, like a really pretty dress and, like, she's there, but then, like, all the dancers are, like, around her and I don't know that, like, some element of movement. I think, like, one of Coldplay's performances was kind of like that. Like, they had a slower song and they had the whole crowd get involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could see something like that happening. So... I think that she's also pretty funny, too. Like, if she wanted to speak and talk to people, like, I think it would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I just, she's not going to be, like, tap dancing up there,
no.
you know?
Yeah.
But I think it would be brilliant. And so her side act, I actually think, should be John Legend.
Ooh.
Because, again, like, he has a very, like, deep, kind of, like, rich voice.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, doesn't he normally play the piano when he's performing and stuff? And so I think that would be, like, a really pretty addition to
definitely.
It. So he not only could maybe, like, blend some of his songs into hers, but then also kind of, like, harmonize with her and play the piano for her. So especially, like you said, I do want them to, like, slow it down in the middle. Maybe just, like, a little piano, like, solo in that moment. So that... And then I was kind of just going off of, like, kind of, like, the rich, like, soulful voices and just making, like, a really beautiful performance. And so my other ones, they're a little bit different. And, again, this would probably be only for, like, a song or two. But I would want Hozier out there because his voice, like, Claire and I went to a concert and... It felt like almost like a religious experience. Like, just like you're just captured by his voice. It's so crazy. And that's like, I've never thought that about any other artist. And like, there's a lot of other artists and concerts that I've been to that I've liked more. But his voice is like one of the most unique and just like,
sure.
I don't know, like envelopes you in and like, I don't know. I felt like we were just, like, in a trance.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
It was just so cool to experience. So if I was someone at the Super Bowl, this is, like, I'd want to hear that voice projected everywhere.
Yeah.
This one I wasn't really sure about. There was a couple people, but I think Lana Del Rey and Adele could do a really beautiful duet.
I almost added Lana to mine.
That's funny. Yeah. None of these people are super upbeat, which, like, might be a concern for a Super Bowl, but I think it would just be gorgeous. There are so many other things that you can do to make it, like, visually stimulating stuff. With lights and dancers and whatever. So, moving into my songs, my opening song has to be Rumor Has It. Because the beginning part...
When you said Adele and you were like, oh, she's not really upbeat, I was like, put a little Rumor Has It on.
Yes.
I'm done.
Exactly.
I'm done.
So, I'm just thinking, like, the beginning where she's repeating, like, ooh, like that. It was so off tone.
No, but, I know exactly what you mean.
Exactly.
I can hear it.
Imagine, like, that comes on and they have, like a huge bass, like, after it. It's maybe paused a little bit. She hasn't come out on the stage yet.
Well, any type of choreography or light show. Exactly. Like, anything can work with that.
Exactly. So, they have that and all of a sudden it's, like, the, like, heavy bass, like, beat drop and she, like, shows up and, like, gets into the song. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great way to open it.
Definitely.
So I have that. Then the crowd favorite, which is where maybe she'd slow it down a little bit, would be Someone Like You. Because, like, I've heard so many audios of, like, entire stadiums singing that song, and it just sounds really cool. Mm-hmm. So that one, maybe John Legend's playing the piano, you know. Mm-hmm. She's holding the microphone to the crowd. Who knows?
Yeah.
And then the closing song would be Set Fire to the Rain.
Yeah.
Because... I feel like that's a good, like, crescendo moment. Like,
definitely.
Really builds up the tension, like, has everyone kind of, like, feeling their feels, but in, like, a very, like, powerful way.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last line is something along the lines of, let it burn.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it would be so cool as if, like, on the lot, like, as she's saying that, with, like, burn, like, fireworks go off, there's, like, sparks everywhere, and she's, like, I don't know, maybe, like, slowly lowering down from the stage.
Uh-huh.
So... something like that, I think you could go out with, like, an actual bang there.
Uh-huh.
So
that's definitely good. I mean, she's, like, a little more, not necessarily flashy, I guess,
right.
but, like, the blues and stuff is, like, up-tempo, and it's got, like you said, a strong bass line and a strong beat and strong drums, and so there's
and
definitely
her voice is just so strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think she's also so popular that, like, even if people... like, everyone knows who
that
is.
Yeah,
so, 1,000%. Like, I don't think anyone wouldn't be that excited. And also, she'd be coming out of basically retirement to do this.
Right.
So, that's another thing.
Yeah, for sure. I'm a big fan. I think
both
of ours are going to be winners.
Yes. Very different, but I think both of them are very good.
Potentially could not be more different.
Yeah, probably
but,
not. Probably
but
not.
They're going to make people happy. And I think if there's ever opportunity, I don't know how Super Bowl works, but... there's an opportunity to, like, pitch them and send them in, or if you're watching.
Yeah, NFL if you're watching. Adele if you're watching.
Miley, Ariana, Justin. We know you're watching. Please take up their offer to the Super Bowl.
Thank you for listening to the 17th episode of The Athlete and the NARP. We hope you enjoyed our discussion about the changing NCAA eligibility rules, as well as our fun Friday where Claire and I put together our ideal Super Bowl halftime performances.
Make sure to follow us on Instagram and TikTok at The Athlete and the NARP. You can contact us by email at theathleteandthenarp@gmail.com with content suggestions, clarifications, or questions. Until next time, I'm Claire Fenton.
And I'm Jenna Daly.
And this has been
The Athlete and the NARP.